Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Around the country, many law enforcement agencies are having a hard time hiring. Here in New Hampshire, local police departments struggle to find younger recruits as the state's aging population means more officers retiring. Also, the job itself is incredibly stressful. And these days, there's increased public skepticism about the actions and motives of law enforcement in the national context of officer-involved shootings. Still, those who choose to wear the uniform say it's a rewarding career, one that allows them, they feel, to make a real positive contribution. Today in The Exchange, how to hire a police force. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We begin with the national picture on this, and with us for that is Tom Jackman, reporter for The Washington Post, where he covers crime in the courts. He's also author of the True Crime blog. You can find a link to that on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Tom, really nice to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to do it.
Well, you've reported on the struggles that many police departments around the country are having finding recruits. What are some of the reasons that you've heard, Tom, that police are having a hard time?
One of the reasons is that they feel the perception of the police as a noble profession have been, you know, harmed, damaged by the news media and also by the proliferation of video cameras of these tragic events that occur when they shoot somebody, when they get involved in an incident. So they believe that that has, harmed their reputation, and that people's families say, really, you want to be a police officer after that? Not recognizing that, you know, 99.9% of police officers don't do the things that the media focus on. We focus on things because they're unusual. And when an unusual thing happens, it can make the police look bad. It should be noted that the police hiring, the number of police being hired has steadily decreased for 20 years. And so this predates the video, the phone video era, but it is certainly one of the number of reasons that the police cite for why they have had trouble hiring and retaining people.
What about salaries in private security organizations? Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I was about to hop that one next, which is that that local police don't pay great. They pay okay. Federal police pay much better. There are a lot of other law enforcement jobs that pay better, and there are private sector jobs that pay better. So there is a component of public service and really having your heart in wanting to serve the public and protect the community. I mean, that's sort of what we forget about sometimes, is that these people volunteer to defend us, to protect us, to serve us. And that gets lost in the noise about isolated bad incidents, which get a lot of publicity. And that publicity harms hiring. There's no doubt about it. With the salary, starting salaries for police officers have never been great. Communities are aware of that. They try to do as best they can in terms of paying, but they're never going to be able to match the feds. And if someone has the chance, a lot of times they'll take a federal law enforcement job, and there are lots of those.
Well, Tom, on this program, we've talked many times about first responder trauma, depression, suicide. New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen just this week announced new federal money aimed at law enforcement, mental health, and wellness. What's the discussion on this nationally? How much is that perhaps also pulling away from the pool of recruits?
It's hard to know how that has hurt the pool or what, you know, how deeply that issue is discussed. But boy, in law enforcement, it is treated as a crisis. It's just remarkable. And I haven't seen stats on it. It seems like it's getting worse. The police chief in New York has been very public about urging anybody in his department who feels like they have a problem to seek help. And just this week here outside of Washington, D.C., a police officer on duty called in that there was a suspicious person in a parking garage, and then when the police responded, he had shot and killed himself in the parking garage.
Oh, my goodness.
And so every police chief, and here in also another department in Fairfax, Fairfax County, Virginia, right outside of Washington, D.C., the chief came forward on a recent, as part of a recent mental health awareness for police, and said, it's not, there's nothing shameful about seeking help. I needed help. I had to get help. I, the chief, I had to get help, and I suffer from PTSD, and he said, if I can do it, and if I can be public about it, any officer can. And so,
well, and we'll talk, we'll talk with our New Hampshire guests about that in just a minute, for sure. A couple more questions for you, Tom, and then we'll fold in our Granite State law enforcement folks. One critique of departments here in New Hampshire and elsewhere is that police forces need to recruit more heavily, more robustly, to better reflect the diversity of their communities. Why is that seen, Tom, as an important goal?
Well, you want your department to look like your community. You want people who can go into a community and, A, relate to it in a proactive process, and, B, be able to find things out in an investigative process. You want, you know, the officers who can get things out of people. And so this is not a new concern, and departments have always tried and succeeded with various degrees in that they sometimes have trouble doing it. Some departments don't, some departments do. The departments around this area need more Hispanic and Asian officers in the D.C. area because we have a lot more Hispanic and Asian residents. And they've struggled with that in part because they feel that in those communities, this is not seen as a noble profession, in part because of where they came from and the countries they came from. The police are corrupt. The police mistreated them. The police brutalized them. And so there's a stigma attached to the profession.
As you reported, Tom, law enforcement leaders around the country have been getting together, sharing ideas on recruitment and retention. Are there any interesting examples that stand out, efforts that seem to be working well?
In Arizona, in Tempe, I believe it was, they're pairing up officers immediately with mentors and with services to both to, you know, to recruit, but then to retain. As soon as somebody joins, they're monitored, and it's made sure that they're getting through the process, and they're handling some of the onerous paperwork that police officers have to deal with, and so making sure that new officers are comfortable and understand what's going on, and that if there's any sort of, you know, ethnic or racial differences, that it's made clear that, you know, the department isn't standing against you. Maybe we just don't get it, but they are trying really hard to recruit and retain folks of all races and ethnicities.
Well, Tom, hold on a moment, because I do want to bring in our New Hampshire guests. And with me in the studio are Chief David Goldstein. He's the chief of police in Franklin. He's been an officer for almost 40 years. He has extensive training and education in mental health issues. And Chief Goldstein, it's always nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Also with us, Lieutenant Brian Kenny. He's been with the Nashua PD for 17 years, recently working with the Detective Bureau and the Narcotics Division. And Lieutenant Kenny, thank you for taking time out.
Thank you, Laura.
And also with us, Professor Michael Raymond. He is a professor of criminal justice and chair of the Criminal Justice Department at NHTI, Concord's Community College. And for 21 years, he was a police officer in Derry. And Professor Raymond, it's really nice to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, all of you, you first, Chief Goldstein, please. What's your experience with bringing new people onto your force? How hard or easy is it?
It's become increasingly more difficult, Tom just said. We're running into a number of different issues. Pay certainly is one of the very largest issues. When you can look at the Walmart distribution center in Raymond and see that they're paying people more an hour to load a truck than we can pay a police officer, right then and there you can see the dichotomy that arises from that. In addition to that, certainly there are a number of issues with the public and the public perception of what we do. And again, as Tom said, it's a very, very, very small percentage. And he kind of made an allusion to the fact of the officer-involved shootings. But we deal with a heck of a lot more than that. And quite frankly, it's still a statistical reality that most of us don't draw our firearms and use them in the line of duty throughout our entire careers.
Wow.
But when it happens, it is a little bit noteworthy and newsworthy. And the media has at times characterized such instances in ways that make made things a little bit negative. For example, if you don't mind, a news station, I'm not going to name them, we work well together, was covering an officer and an officer-involved shooting in Vermont. And the reporter kept referring to the individual who was shot by the police. By the way, there was body cam. It was pretty straightforward. As the victim, which means then the alternate to that is that the police officer was the perpetrator. So these are some of the small nuances that we have to deal with, and people continually pick up on stuff like that.
I have to ask about the pay issue. So you're saying people can make more money loading a truck for Walmart than they can patrolling the streets for you in Franklin?
Yes, they can. For a new police officer in Franklin who's never been a police officer, we have a step process for pay. The lowest step, yes.
So pay, public perception, those are some of the issues that you're bumping up against. How about you, Lieutenant Kenny? How easy or hard is it to bring people onto the Nashua Police Force?
It's difficult for us, and this topic is rather new for me. I spent most of my time buried in the Detective Bureau, kind of in the nitty-gritty of what we do. But since being transferred over to professional standards, we're in charge of recruiting. And I can tell you, we just ran a test last month, and we're running more tests now. We used to run two a year. We're running them every month now just to try to get more people in the door on a more routine basis. And we had 19 people show up.
Is that a lot or a little?
When I took the test 17 years ago, there was 250, and we ran a morning session and an afternoon session.
No kidding. Wow, so, that's a big difference.
Yeah, so the numbers are a little different because we're running it more often, but they still don't compare to what it was then. People were seeking us out, and we're finding ourselves having to seek them out at this point.
Wow. And why do you suppose that is, Lieutenant Kenny?
Well, that's a complicated question.
Yeah, we've got a whole hour.
But I wish I had that answer.
I'd love your thoughts, and we'll get into details later, but just broadly.
We're looking at a whole bunch of different things on, you know, how kids coming out of college and how people looking for their first job are going about it now. And they're not knocking on our door anymore. So we're trying to up our presence on social media and reach people that way and advertising on things like Facebook and all different sorts of stuff. And to be honest, currently we're trying to see the results of that in the coming months. It's fairly new to us.
All right. We'll talk about social media for sure. The double-edged sword of it in terms of how it affects police departments. But I'd love to hear from you too, Professor Raymond, your thoughts on some of the factors that Tom mentioned, that your colleagues mentioned, that might be hindering police recruitment efforts.
It's interesting because I come from a different angle. High school kids that are excited about a new career, and they explore. One of the places they explore is criminal justice. And what's interesting is we bring in, we're probably the largest degree-granting program in the community college. We bring in the largest number of first-year students. But when graduation time comes around 2 years later, it's about 50 or 60% of the ones that came in. Because it's an exploratory area, they think they want to be a cop, they watch TV. When we discuss social media, we'll discuss that part of it also. But their perception of being a police officer and what a police officer actually does are two different things. So they come in, they see it, and they say, I don't think I want to do this. I hearken back to my law enforcement career, and when we have orientations with new students, I talk about enjoying Christmas, enjoying birthdays. And I tell them in my 21 years as law enforcement, I worked 18 Christmases. And that was a strain from the very beginning to the very end, but that's the reality. And I don't think a lot of these kids think, because they watch it on TV and a homicide is solved in 45 minutes commercials, that that's how it really works. And when they realize that and they realize the hours and the commitment, they sort of move on to something else.
So what do you say to them when they're kind of on the fence as to whether they want to continue with this or not?
Then I break it down into the most basic of terms is, do you think at some point, if you have to in your career, can you pull the trigger? Can you take somebody's life to save yours or a third person? And once they start to think about that, a lot of the kids, they're not ready for that. Now, I see a good portion of students that leave that come back 2 or 3 years later and say, I'm mature now, I can do it, and then they continue with their studies. But a lot of 18, 19-year-old kids aren't sure of where they want to be yet in life.
So in terms of the lifestyle factors, it's kind of a shock. And some of those questions that you raise about, you know, defending yourself or others. What other issues do you think, Professor Raymond, are at play with these local departments that are having a hard time hiring?
I think it's more generational. I think that the generation today is different than the generation of mine or Lieutenant Kenny's or Chief Goldstein's. They want instant gratification. It's all the different advantages they have don't really set them up for a career. When you think about a retirement system, if you think about health insurance, the kids don't think about that coming out of high school because they've been on their parents' health insurance, and they don't think about a pension system or a retirement system at that age, and they don't see a career.
They don't see the advantages of a career in the local police department.
In my age group and in Chief Goldstein's age group, is we looked at a career, would do a job. He's been doing it for close to 40 years. I did it for over 21. Lieutenant Kenny's at 17. The average kid today leaves a job at about 2.5 years. So there's a whole different dynamic of what you want to do as a job versus a profession.
You know, Tom, last question for you. We've been talking a lot about recruitment, and we will talk about that throughout the hour. But what about retention, given the costs of hiring and training? Of course, departments want to keep good officers on the force. So what are some departments that you've looked at, Tom, doing toward that end, not just recruitment, but retention?
Well, they're trying to be competitive. A lot of them are very aggressive in trying to make their salaries and their benefit packages competitive. Pension plans for police officers typically are pretty good compared to the private sector, especially as pension plans are going away in the private sector. I'm pretty sure Walmart isn't going to pay the pension that a police department is going to pay. And trying to build community support for their officers, to remind people what these guys and women do. It's, you know, the professor touched on the fact that a lot of the kids in college aren't aware of what police officers do or what the job is, and that's true in the community as well, that so many people don't grasp all the stuff that police officers do, not just the stuff that makes it to the TV shows, all the valuable services. A lot of people do. A lot of people will go up to officers and say thank you for your service, but a lot of people have no idea what the job is, and so they're trying to create an environment where police officers feel appreciated, where they don't feel under attack by the bad guys, by the news media, on social media, by protest groups. They're trying to make their departments more welcoming places for their own employees.
Well, Tom, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
It's a great topic and a great chat, and I've been very interested to be here.
That's Tom Jackman. He's a reporter for The Washington Post, where he covers crime and the courts. He's also the author of the True Crime blog. You can find a link on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. Tom also mentioned, by the way, suicide rates among police officers. I want to give the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. When this topic comes up, we always try to do that. It's 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-8255. Talk. After a short break, I want to ask our New Hampshire guests about some of the items that Tom raised, including public image, social media, reaching out to young people, all the themes that you guys touched on. We'll dig in a lot more, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. We'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, police hiring and recruitment. Many local departments say it's a challenge to find qualified recruits and retain the ones they do hire and train. We're looking into this, and let's hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio, Professor Michael Raymond. He's a professor of criminal justice and chair of the Criminal Justice Department at NHTI. For 21 years, he was a police officer in Derry. Lieutenant Brian Kenny is here. He's been with the Nashua PD for 17 years. He recently joined the Professional Standards Bureau, which focuses on recruitment and training. And also with us, Chief David Goldstein. He's the chief in Franklin. He's been an officer for almost 40 years. And all of you, let's go right to our listeners. And Brendan is calling in. Hi, Brendan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Laura.
Sure. Go ahead.
I am actually the commander of the State Police Recruitment and Training Unit. I've been a beneficiary of the leadership of Chief Goldstein. Good morning, gentlemen. It's great to hear from all you guys. And I just wanted also to chime in and I guess echo a lot of their comments with regard to the difficulties of recruitment. Just like Lieutenant Kenny said, in the early 2000s when I applied, there were hundreds of applicants for a handful of positions, and nowadays we're lucky if we get 150 applicants for upwards of 30 or 40 open vacancies within the division. And yet, even among those who appear, those rates are really pretty bad. And those who pass their physical fitness test, for example, even to advance further into the process, those rates are abysmal, especially when we consider the low standards. So it has been, continues to be a difficult time in recruitment. And I'd just like to thank those gentlemen for their willingness to talk about that and hopefully encouraging people to enter into the privilege that we have within this profession to serve humanity around us. It's a great profession.
Well, Brendan, I'm glad you called. If I could ask you a question or two, since you mentioned the physical fitness test and sort of other thresholds that people have to meet, have those standards or thresholds been changing or have they stayed the same?
They stayed relatively the same, and with New Hampshire State Police, we use the Cooper Fitness Institute standards, which basically is a cardiovascular research institute in the southwest of the country. And we require people based on age and gender, age groups and gender, to pass those standards at the 50th percentile, which in and of itself is a fairly interesting thing. It denotes that for the person who passes that test, that half of the population at their gender and at their age or within their group could physically be superior to them, and it is we who stand between predators and potential prey. So that by itself is fairly telling as to the level of preparedness that we're seeing from people. But you know, we encourage our people that fitness is a lifestyle. Long periods of sitting in a cruiser, punctuated by short and extremely intense, sometimes physical struggles and efforts to do what we need to do to protect ourselves and others.
Well, between a quarter and a third of New Hampshire adults are overweight or obese, so you know you're facing a less physically fit population, perhaps. There, what about past drug use or you know sort of low level criminal problems? Is that still a no? You're out if you have any of that on your record.
Well, to varying degrees, we really rely on the Police Standard and Training Council's rules with regard to who is allowed to continue in the process. And there are, without question, some immediate disqualifiers. So a person who's been convicted of a felony, a person who has certain convictions that have not been annulled or actually even pardoned, which is a difficult process to get through. People who have feloniously used narcotic or controlled drugs within a period of 3 years prior to the date of their application, people who've used marijuana within a year of their application date, those are all automatic disqualifiers. And for many of the other issues, including, well, sales of a narcotic drug is a disqualifier as well. But for many of the other issues, you know, minor offenses in their personal histories, depending on severity and recency and a number of those transgressions, we really have to parse through those things very carefully to make sure that we're bringing people on who are going to do it right.
Okay. Well, it's good to hear from you, Brendan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What do you think, Professor Raymond, about the standards, the qualifications, and just the fact that, you know, it sounds like Brendan's saying we have them, but we also have to look at each case individually?
We do, and from the college perspective, we preach this from the very beginning. We preach physical ability. If you want to get into the field, start now. And what we teach in college is from the day you walk into the door to orientation, which you've done in the past, you own. From then forward, you need to understand that if you want to be in the field, you need to meet these standards. Now, the state police, for example, under Lieutenant Davey and Colonel Wagner, they're very, very aggressive in recruiting. We see them on the campus. We see them on other college campuses. Commissioner Hanks of the Department of Corrections, she has another unit that's very, very involved in recruiting because it's difficult to find good quality candidates. So they come in at the first year of college. They come into high schools. I've seen them in high schools recruiting, letting kids know what the standards are in advance. And
so that they're not surprised.
So they're not surprised when they know how many sit-ups, how many push-ups, and how fast or how far they have to run in a time period. We preach that because we know that that could be a potential impediment. And as much as we do, some kids just say, I guess, again, it's generational. They'll get to it. Where we prepare 2 weeks in advance, they may prepare 2 minutes in advance. And that's they tend to fail because they wait till the last minute. They don't have proper training, and that's what we try to instill at the college level, working with the different agencies to have these kids prepared when they get out of school.
Lieutenant Kenny, how much are local departments like Nashua's in a little bit of competition with state police? Maybe that's more prestigious, maybe the pay is better, maybe it seems like a more exciting field than being with the Nashua PD or the Franklin PD.
Sure, well, there's undoubtedly competition between all of us in a good way, but we can all agree that the candidate pool is smaller than it used to be. So by virtue of the size of the candidate pool, we're competing against each other.
Sure.
So if I run a test on the same day as state police, then I'm not getting half of the people that might test if I run a test on a different day, because people will take numerous police tests. And, you know, they're coming out of school like myself. I was coming out of school and I was looking for a police job. But you can't put all your eggs in one basket, and you want to test with a bunch of different places and get your foot in the door somewhere. So we're fighting to get our hands on all those folks with everybody else.
Brendan, thank you for calling. And I want to share an email from Sandy, who says, there's not enough time training for the 30 hours a week when the need is to help neighbors, as opposed to the attitude that everyone is suspicious, so treat them like potential criminals. Actually, Sandy says we need more sociology added to the curriculum, that conflict is difficult to deal with. I think she's getting at, Chief Goldstein, the idea that, you know, there is this distrust among police that you mentioned at the beginning of the show. This sort of the public, and they see the stories, and they're not sure if police are on their side or not.
That, too, is a complicated question with a number of different layers to it. And what Sandy has said is a little bit simplistic, quite frankly. There's an awful lot of sociology in police work. There's an awful lot of psychology in police work. And traditionally, it's always been there. If she's concerned that we look at people a little bit differently than most, we most certainly do. If nothing else, it's self-protective. We want to go home at the end of the day, so to speak. And that leads us into some of the statistics that I mentioned during our break that I can refer to. For example, we lose a police officer in the line of duty every 53 to 54 hours in this country. We have 800,000 police officers, give or take. We're a country of 350 million people. So the ratio right there is really skewed. Now, not all of those line of duty deaths are felonious. However, if you just take out the felonies of about 59 or 60 per year, and we start looking at suicides, now we're losing a police officer in this country every 53 hours to a suicide. That's incredible. The statistics now become more and more skewed. We suffer over 50,000 assaults on police officers a year throughout this country. Of that 50,000, we lose 10% every year because of the severity, either emotional and or physical, result of that assault. So now, if nothing else, which is not really the best way to put it, but if nothing else, we're looking at a financial loss. The community is looking at a financial loss. We invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in training and education. If you look at conditions like, which is the catchword of the day, post-traumatic stress disorder, of the 800,000 of us or so, it's clinically estimated that between 125 and 150,000 police officers are walking around, as we speak, with diagnosable PTSD. That's horrific. So we understand the sociology. We understand the psychology. We also understand that there are a lot of people out there that don't want us around. People do not want to be told, for the most part, what to do. If I have to get here and I'm running late, I'm going to speed on the highway. Then I'm stopped by a trooper for doing 85 and a 55, and I want to know why he or she is doing that. I've got to get there. So these are just some of the things that we deal with. But trust me when I tell you that we do appreciate the communities that hire us, whether it's at the state level, the county level, or the local level.
What about the trust factor? I want to hear from all three of you on this because, you know, you mentioned this at the beginning, Chief Goldstein, this is an issue. The media, social media, regular media, giving attention to some of these police incidents, trust is diminished. What impact do you see these having on public feelings about their police and about whether people want to consider this career? This especially comes up when the officer is white and the suspect is black, reinforcing negative perceptions that police don't care about minority communities. I really want to hear from everybody on this because you all touched on it in the beginning. This is a big deal. So Chief Goldstein, you first, but Lieutenant Kenny and Professor Raymond, too. How do you get beyond that and how do you feel about that?
I guess there are a number of different things we can do. Certainly, first and foremost, is ongoing training and education for our people to make sure that we know how other people see us as well as how we see them. There's a great deal of work being done out there in cultural diversity. In fact, I teach a course in that and how we view each other. When we start to appreciate what each of us does, then I think we'll see a lot more understanding and a lot more interest in what goes on. In my department, for example, I have an open door policy. If I'm in and a citizen wants to stop in and talk about anything, come on in. If I'm busy, we'll make an appointment. If I'm not, we'll sit down right then and there and talk. This is the way that I can communicate with my citizenry. Same thing when I was with the state police. If someone wanted to talk, I could take a couple extra moments to do that. But at the same time, we also have to understand that there are certain realities out there, and we don't know where the next one is coming from. And as a result, we're a little bit on edge. And I challenge anybody listening to this program not to think that way. If you're a military veteran, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're a police officer, you know exactly what I'm talking about. If you're a firefighter and you're walking through a burning building and someone's decided to cut a hole in the floor and put a rug over it as you're walking through and you fall two stories, you know what I'm talking about.
Phew, yeah. And we did a whole show on mental health issues, PTSD, trauma among first responders a couple months ago with Correct. Police and firefighters. And I think you might have been on that show,
I was, yes.
Chief Goldstein. I think your department, Lieutenant Kenny, has been involved in what's called implicit bias training in terms of working with communities of color and so forth. I'd love to hear you talk about that and also just this trust issue given this national narrative.
Sure. To echo Chief Goldstein, I think the first thing you have to do is be able to look at yourself in the mirror and acknowledge what's going on in the country, right, wrong, or indifferent, or whether you think something's been blown out of proportion or not, but it's being focused on nonetheless. So you have to be able to look at your own department and look at yourselves and say, hey, are we trained up to the best of our ability? Do we need to talk about things like implicit bias? And it's one of the routine things that we do. We focus on training a lot in Nashua. So it's routinely, whether it be a day of training, a week of training, or just quick training that you get on a nightly basis, maybe 10 minutes after you get to work, and we'll cover a topic, and then you hit the street after that. But second to that, the public doesn't always know that we're doing these ongoing things. And in just getting out in the community is very important for us, the community that we work in. So whether that's going to downtown Nashua for a community event and setting up a desk there, or just having the officers that are on the walking beats walk through, a festival of some kind, or, you know, a program for kids at the local ice cream store, things like that. You know, Nashua's a city in New Hampshire, but we're still not New York City, and you're able to get into the community and meet people. And then, hey, when they see something on the news, whether it be positive or negative, maybe they're not influenced as much about their local police department if they have some hands-on knowledge about us.
So community policing is still really important. We've been hearing about that for a couple of decades now. How does the Nashua Police Department reach out to diverse communities? I think your city is the most diverse in New Hampshire, or maybe you in Manchester maybe are the same. How do you reach out to those communities?
So we have officers that go out and meet with minority communities on a regular basis, people that, folks in certain communities within Nashua, certain neighborhoods. I can tell you my recruiting officer today is giving a tour to a Brazilian group in Nashua. And it's one of the efforts we're doing to get more interest in minority groups in our profession.
In hopes of recruiting some of those people.
Exactly. And if nothing else, even if it's not for recruitment, it's for understanding about our building, understanding of what we do from people that perhaps come from a different culture.
I have to ask you too, Professor Raymond, about this, public perception issue that Chief Goldstein raised initially. And people see, these repeated incidents of officer-involved shootings, sometimes, very tragic and frustrating and poor decision-making. And I just wonder how you think police departments should deal with that in this day and age and how they can do better.
The younger police officers coming in have a real advantage. More are formally educated than before. And as the caller or the email had sent saying about more sociology, more psychology, out of the 19 classes for a criminal justice associate's degree, only 9 are criminal justice related. The other 10 are general studies. And it covers psychology. It covers sociology. It covers crisis intervention. And at the community college level at NHTI in the criminal justice program, we have a great opportunity because most of our students, the criminal justice students, are white males. But we also have a real diverse population of an immigrant population in the city of Concord. So the students that come from Nepal, that come from Bhutan, come from Central Africa, that don't have that same perception of police, we've set up a program in the past, and we started this program called Conversation Partners, where we take the criminal justice students and we sit down for 45 minutes and we line them up with a student coming, an immigrant student. So the future police officer, the criminal justice student, is allowed to learn how to be an active listener. And the immigrant population student learns about police department in the United States.
That's really interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
We take that as they then go on to the police academy and get hired by an agency and go through the police academy. They have that background. And they also have the psychology. They also have the sociology. They also have the crisis intervention classes to at least get them started in the process.
So at a bare minimum, those efforts that you described are connecting people of different communities so that they understand each other, including future police officers. But is there some hope also with those efforts that you might actually recruit some of these new Americans to the police force here in New Hampshire?
Absolutely. I was talking with Carla Cordo, who does the recruiting for Manchester Police Department yesterday. He's doing a background on a student exactly from that program.
All right. Lots more calls and emails after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Join us for that, Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, why local police departments are having a hard time hiring and what some are doing about it. Let's hear from you. Your emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. www.thepolicepodcast.org. With me in studio, Chief David Goldstein. He's chief in Franklin. He's been a police officer for almost 40 years. Lieutenant Brian Kenny is here. He's with the Nashua PD for 17 years. He recently joined the Professional Standards Bureau, focusing on recruiting and training new officers. And Professor Michael Raymond is with us. He's a professor of criminal justice at NHTI. And for 21 years, he was a police officer in Derry. All of you, let's go right back to our listeners. Cameron is calling in from Manchester. Hi, Cameron. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to send my condolences to the Nashua lieutenant about the loss of their Captain Leto recently. I'm sorry for your loss.
Yeah,
thank you, Cameron.
Yeah.
My question is, how does sending non-violent offenders, for example, drug addicts, alcoholics, and the mentally ill, to the Valley Street Jail hurt the image of the policing community? As you may know, this jail has hundreds of human rights violations and is hopefully in the process of being shut down. I know personally from conversations with many people in the community, just one overnight stay in this jail can tarnish a person's trust in law enforcement.
You know, Cameron, I'm glad you called because we're doing a show on bail reform next week. So I'll set that aside mostly for now. But Chief Goldstein, it's a judgment call, right? You're on the street. Somebody's causing trouble. How do you make that quick judgment call to put the person in the jail?
Well, Laura, that does come under the rubric of the bail reform that you're going to examine next week. So if we're talking about times in the past, it's basically that we came in contact with someone, we effected an arrest, and in order to give that individual or keep that individual within the system, they went to the county jail, if not the lockup in the local police department. And then there was a system for that individual to be evaluated and either kept or released, and that was the bail system. So that in and of itself is traditional. Today, it's a lot more complicated than that, and we do recognize the mental health aspects about all of this. Unfortunately, we don't have any other resources than either our own lockups, county jails, or if we're lucky enough, an emergency room that's willing to take someone and hold them until they can be admitted into a locked facility.
Okay, Cameron. Well, I will say for now, stay tuned because we will be talking about this next week. Let's go to Andrew in Hancock. Andrew, you're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call in. I moved to New Hampshire 2 years ago from Washington, D.C., where we were incredibly fortunate to have just an amazing chief of police named Kathy Lanier. When I was there, Kathy had something like an 87% public approval rating, despite having some of the worst wealth disparities and some of the worst racial disparities anywhere in the country. I wanted to call because the way your guests and some of your colleagues have talked about the job of being a police officer is so antithetical to how Kathy would talk about it with DC police officers. I'll give you a good example. We've heard terms like defend the population and predator and prey and how police stand between them. Like that model of a warrior cop, like, I don't think is particularly adopted at the national level anymore, but is so different for how progressive police departments in the United States seem to think about the role of policing today. So I'm curious if anybody has stopped to think that perhaps there's association between the way police officers tend to talk about the job and the fact that nobody seems to want this job anymore.
Wow. Okay, Andrew, lots to chew on there. I really appreciate it. And Professor Raymond, I'm going to throw that to you first, sort of the dual role and the language around the dual role of a police officer.
Well, first I have to comment on Andrew talking about the Washington, D.C. Police Department, and he is correct with the professionalism of that department. One of the things that they did early on is they required each of their recruits to take a tour through the Holocaust Museum. So they were taught at the police academy level, at the basic level, about human rights and human dignity. So I agree with them with the Washington, D.C. Police Department. With regard to the terms that are used, I guess that's reality. What is somebody that's walking down the street that gets hit from behind and has their wallet or pocketbook stolen? They're a prey. They were walking in the wrong place at the wrong time or something happened. And who did that to them? or her is a predator. They stole from that person. You could call it any other terms that you like, but that's the reality of what it is.
Do you want to jump in, Lieutenant Kenny? This gets back to what we talked about earlier, community policing,
sure.
The image of what police work is. It's complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. I mean, I think we can always take a look at what terms we're using, right? So, you know, terms like what the caller referenced may or may not be, appropriate in a certain circumstance. But at the end of the day, the policemen are being put in situations, in the middle of situations. So, you know, to reference an earlier email about the sociology and this and that, you're going to be called to a situation and you're going to be put in the middle of two people. At the end of that situation, whatever it is, one of those people is not pleased with the service that they got. And this is the nature of what we do. So, you know, there's always going to be that sentiment. But to the caller's point, we can all be cognizant of how we're talking and how our words are going to affect people. And that's a constant evaluation. None of us are perfect. We're all people. We all might use a term or say something that can be interpreted in a different way. So we just have to be conscious about it.
You worked for a time, Lieutenant Kenny, in the narcotics division in Nashua. How did that work sort of influence the way that you see the role of policing?
Right.
You're dealing with people who are struggling with addiction and their families and so on and so forth. So again, it's not that, you know, cop show that the professor mentioned earlier,
sure,
where everything, the homicide is solved in 45 minutes. I just wonder how your work in the Narcotics Bureau informs your broader work and what you just want to share about.
Sure,
that.
Sure. That's a lot of my background, to be completely honest. You know, we use terms now that we never used to use, like substance use disorder, things like that. You know, you hear about, oh, it's the good guys versus the bad guys, and it's this and that. Well, it's not that simple, right? And we're starting to look at things like that. We're starting to get involved in Nashua with recovery centers, things that are going to keep people out of, let's say, the Valley Street Jail and in the community and engaging positively in the community, whether they're down at a recovery center, getting resources on housing, getting resources on how to find employment, or just getting access to meetings at night, things like that. It's all things that we have to be cognizant about. We have to be involved, and we have to talk to our policemen about it. You know, hey, when you're talking to this person out on the street, they're going through this. Just be aware of it, and that helps you engage that person positively.
Chief Goldstein, do you think young people who are interested in this profession realize how much of it is social work, not law enforcement per se in that old-fashioned sense, but a lot of it is social work?
I don't, and nobody really does, because most
people...
Did
you, when you were first getting in?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Absolutely not. And I'd wanted to be a cop since I was 5 years old. So I realized my dream. But no, we don't realize that until you're immersed in that. And hopefully the academy is the starting point for that. We have an excellent academy here, one academy for the entire state. If you have any law enforcement authority in the state of New Hampshire, you have to be certified by that one agency. Unlike other states that have either collegiate models, or in Massachusetts, for example, that has a number of different academies on the both on the local and state levels.
So there's some consistency there.
Correct. And people know what everybody knows, what everybody else knows, so to speak. But to answer your question, I guess the one word answer is no, we don't know that until we get out there and we realize that we're dealing with people on a variety of different levels. We see them on their worst day, quite frankly. For the most part, they're not coming into the station saying, hi, how you doing? Thank you very much. They're coming into the station saying, I have a problem. Or we're being dispatched to an area where someone says, I have a problem. And as the lieutenant said, if it's two individuals and they're having an argument, they're both right until we get there. And then somebody's wrong. And people don't like that. That's human nature. So I guess, again, the answer is no.
Let's take another email. Thank you for that call. Carol from Peterborough asks, what are your policies on recruiting LGBTQ officers? And Emily has a similar question in Bedford. She says, as a female military officer, I know firsthand the benefit of gender diversity within roles that are historically considered male roles. Emily says she's interested in knowing what is being done to recruit and retain more female officers. Now, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but maybe you first, Lieutenant Kenny. Recruiting among LGBTQ community, recruiting among women. I'd love to hear your roles, what you're doing in that role as well. We talked earlier about reaching out to minority communities.
Sure. Well, I mean, we're trying to reach out to whoever we can reach out to who we think could appropriately act in a uniform. So by all means, we're open to any candidate pool whatsoever. You know, a few years ago, we had a big push in Nashua. It was women in policing. And we pushed out a women in policing video where we featured a bunch of our female officers. And we got a lot of great feedback from that.
Did it work? Did you get some good recruits?
We did. But we're going to revisit it again.
Social media. We've talked about this earlier as a double-edged sword. I'd love to get everybody's thoughts on that. But maybe you first, Professor Raymond, how you see police departments using social media and how you see younger people who are coming in to become police officers who get training with you at NHTI, how they view the role of social media in terms of a tool of recruitment or a tool of, you know, how people view police.
I from the college aspect, it's more of a learning experience for students. And I'll give you an example. I had an 18-year-old female student squared away. I just knew that she had a future in law enforcement. At 19, she applied to a police department as a dispatcher. She went in for the interview. She did fantastic. And in her background check, they looked at her social media pages and saw a 19-year-old girl standing with holding a beer can, hugging a refrigerator full of beer. They called her in and they said, "We really like you, but we're not going to give you the job. You need to grow up." She came back from that experience and we sat down in my office and I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "I learned a valuable lesson. I won't do that again." And from that point on, she just geared herself towards being a police officer, and she's a police officer now in New Hampshire on a border community with Massachusetts and doing fantastic. But social media, as my contemporaries talk about, is a double-edged sword, and it is, because the students don't realize at the time what they're posting could have an adverse effect on them later on, and it takes a while for that to go away. It's like maturity. So I think that it helps the maturity process.
How, to reference our emailers' questions, how much do you see among the young people that you work with more diversity? We talked about racial diversity either, but what about women? What about people from the LGBTQ community? Are you seeing more of those folks coming in to be possibly new police officers?
We are. In the program we are, and I'm very proud to say at NHTI, 35% of the criminal justice program are female. And I've seen that transition. I started in 1980, and my police academy class was all males. And that's changed dramatically. In the 90s, it started to change. And now I've seen it grow leaps and bounds with minority and female police officers. And again, I'm proud to say 35% of the program is female.
Chief Goldstein, what about social media? How do you see that as a double-edged sword in terms of the work you do? Lieutenant Kenny talked about it was a great way to reach out to a different group of people for recruitment. But then we also talked about, you know, the downsides of it.
Well, we do the same thing. We have a department Facebook page, and we put out all kinds of information, good stuff, bad stuff, somebody that might be wanted, a dog that's missing, anything like that. And the community responds very well to that. But similar to Professor Raymond, I had a recruit whom I interviewed, gave her an initial interview. She looked great on paper. She looked great in her presence, She began the testing process, and all of a sudden a social media page came out. She was 20 years old at the time, and there she is with alcohol. Whether we agree or disagree, 21 is the legal age. I have no choice at that point. I have to say thank you, but no thank you. Try again at some other time. So there's the double-edged sword issue. Kids will be kids. We all were at one time, I assume. And as a result, we all did very silly things, and we survived, and hopefully we learned from that, and that's the best that we can ask.
I have to ask all of you about this. The rise in mass shootings around the country, public shootings in general, a shopping mall in Concord just a couple weeks ago, and then a church in Pelham just last week. Chief Goldstein, how does this affect, if at all, your ability to recruit good people? Or are they looking at the environment going, whoa, too dangerous?
Again, I think it has both a positive and a negative to it.
Really?
The positive would be an individual who is willing to put themselves, and I am going to use it, between the prey and the predator, and do their job. The negative certainly is it's very, very dangerous. It's going into a legitimate type of combat, not knowing what's going to come out at the other end. and the potential for looking at a school or a some sort of shopping center or something where there are victims is not necessarily a pretty vision.
And another question for you, Professor Raymond. We've talked a lot about, you know, issues with police departments. And from what I understand, in some small towns in New Hampshire, they don't even have a whole police department, or they might have like one officer. How are these issues different if we're talking about a very small town versus Nashua or Franklin?
I don't think they are different. I think the job is the job, whether you're in the largest agency in the state or the smallest agency in the state. It's just the degree of what you deal with it. If you're in a very small community, in a northern New Hampshire community, you depend more on other police officers from other communities because you can't handle it alone. And that's why this state is so unique. As Chief Goldstein alluded to, the police academy is everybody goes to the same place. And friendships and professional associations develop there, and they continue. I know my academy class 39 years ago. I'm still friends with the people, and I'm sure that my other two, my contemporaries, will say the same thing. And that's where you develop those friendships. And so you can talk about that, and you can know that the problems are pretty much the same everywhere.
Last quick question for you, Lieutenant Kennedy. What's one practice or change that you've made in your department that has made a difference in recruitment?
I think social media makes a big difference. You know, that's something that we're focusing on. I mean, within the past few months, we actually pulled an officer out of his current assignment, and he's dedicated solely to recruitment. So we've always done a level of recruiting, and it was done more on a group basis, like my entire division. Now we have a dedicated person to do just recruiting because it's that important and it's that difficult to find people.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. The theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.